Want me?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. More coffee first. Hello and welcome to PaleoCast. I'm John Tennant, and today with me we have Dave Marshall. Hi, Dave.
Hello, John.
All right, man. How you getting along?
I'm doing all right, thank you very much.
How's the PhD hunt going?
The PhD hunt, it's going pretty well. I've got a couple of applications away, so hopefully they'll be listening.
What is it you're shooting for, without naming names?
I'm looking at proposing my own. That's my number one route that I want to go. It's dissolving out rocks with acids and seeing what kind of arthropod cuticle you can get left behind. Yeah, so how's your PhD going?
It's pretty good. I'm enjoying being one of Mannion's minions at the moment. I wonder if you'll be
Mannion's
listening to him.
minions? Who's
Yeah,
Mannion?
my supervisor is Phil Mannion. He used to work on sauropods,
All right, okay.
but now he works on things like latitudinal biodiversity gradients and tetrapods in the Mesozoic and Paleocene.
I've got no idea what that first thing you said was, but anyway,
What was the first thing?
I don't know. You said a load of big words and I didn't get them.
What you get from being an invertebrate worker.
Yeah, so tell us where you're up to on it. And remind us again what you're doing and where you're up to.
I'd rather not do that in public. At the moment, it's a little embarrassing.
Oh, you're not very far.
Well, it's been about 2 months, and I'm chomping through the data at the moment and the various bits of the literature review.
Yeah, so
It's quite.
you've just got to. What's this literature review? What have you got to do for that?
Well, at the moment, it's reviewing mechanisms of extinctions and patterns of diversity through time, and as well as that, I'm also doing a bit more detailed monographic work on a family of little dwarf crocodiles called Otoposaurids. So if
Okay.
anybody's listening to this, please don't start researching them, because that's what I want to do. That'll do.
Yeah, it's nice to imagine all these tiny little crocodiles walking about in the Mesozoic when you had all these giant dinosaurs.
Yeah. Well, I think they were quite niche, so the places which you find them in typically are quite high crocodile diversity. So you usually get a couple of big beasts, and then there's these little dwarf ones going around, and we think they were kind of competing with little lizards.
All right, okay. So, yeah, who have we got today? Who are we
Okay.
interviewing?
Today we've got Dr. Dave Hone. He works at Queen Mary at the moment in London, but has quite extensive experience working on theropods and vertebrate ecology throughout the Mesozoic in Bristol and China. So we're hoping to draw on some of his experience working with them. So yeah, I mean, if you want to read about his work, you can get, he's got he blogs for The Guardian and also has the infamous Arcosaur Musing webpage where he blogs quite consistently about various aspects of vertebrate ecology and evolution and dinosaurs. Dave also contributes to pterosaur.net, and he's also the creator of Ask a Biologist, which is a website targeted at school kids and students where they can actually directly ask, you know, these expert researchers questions in biology, paleontology, etc., etc. It's quite cool, actually. I think he's had something like over 1 million questions or something so far.
Well, let's ask a paleontologist a few questions.
Oh, you didn't. With us today, we've got Dr. Dave Hone, infamous blogger from Arcosaur Musings and The Guardian. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being with us today. Can you
Hi,
tell us a
Dave.
little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a vertebrate paleontologist, as you say. I specialize on theropod dinosaurs, so that's the carnivorous group that goes up to and includes birds and the pterosaurs, the flying reptiles that everyone thinks are dinosaurs but aren't. And I've been doing this since I finished my PhD. Well, as part of my PhD and finishing my PhD, so from about 10 years now.
How did you initially get into the field of paleontology? I mean, what inspired you to get involved with dead things?
I'm rather unusual compared to a lot of the dinosaur people or paleo people in general, in that I did kind of fall into it almost accidentally. So I've always been, you know, from the age of literally two, fascinated by animals and wildlife and living and dead organisms of almost every kind. And I went and did a zoology degree and was most interested in animal behavior, and then went off and did a master's in the Natural History Museum in London. And for my research project for that, I ended up working on dinosaurs rather by chance. It was the original project that I was supposed to be doing fell through at the last minute because we discovered that another group was just about to publish something that me and my supervisor dreamt up between us. So we had to find something at short notice. And that was actually a dinosaur super tree. And that's just been published. So rather than going do our own competing one, which was never going to be as good, where the research group were actually generous enough to let us use their data and then start messing around with what we could do with that. And what we started looking at was dinosaur body size changes and using that phylogeny as a template. And that kind of got me back into dinosaurs. I had liked them as a kid. I did love them. I found them fascinating, but I was never dinosaurs, dinosaurs, dinosaurs kind of guy. And then hunting around for PhDs, some similar stuff was available. And I, you know, kind of had my appetite whetted again and got back into it. And so I ploughed on with pterosaurs and it kind of carried on from there. I'd got committed in more ways than one.
I guess the next big question is, what is it about dinosaurs and pterosaurs and other organisms like that that make them so appealing to not just researchers, but also the public?
I have to say, I really don't know. It's something I've talked about with several friends and colleagues. It's something I've actually blogged about once or twice and spoken to the public and other people as well. And everyone gives a different answer, all of which are interesting and all of which are plausible. And of course, it's probably some combination of just about everything. But, you know, the dinosaurs were truly enormous. You know, there's never been terrestrial organisms that got anything like their size in terms of the big ones. They're fantastically weird and alien to us in a way that a lot of, you know, terrestrial animals are not these days. You know, crocodiles are quite weird when you think about it. Snakes are quite weird compared to traditional kind of fluffy mammals and birds. But, you know, things like Tyrannosaurus rex, things like Diplodocus, things like Stegosaurus really are very strange indeed. That's probably part of it. I remember years ago reading someone's kind of ad hoc hypothesis that it was a kind of safe things for kids to get excited about. It was something that, you know, it was a dangerous and scary thing, but at the same time it's relatively safe because these things are long dead. And that kind of also sounds plausible. I don't know, but it is pretty universal. And the one thing I have noted is the children of several of my colleagues really don't care about dinosaurs. The only kids I've ever seen who don't find dinosaurs interesting, their parents are zoologists who work on dinosaurs.
Oh,
in that case, I suspect they're just bored of them because it's all they ever see is like mum and dad just trucking around with these giant skulls and mucking around in museums with huge skeletons everywhere, and they're just blasé about them.
You've done quite a lot of research over in China. Can you tell us about some of the fossils you've either found or worked on whilst you've been over there?
Yeah, well, I had 3 years in Beijing as a researcher at the IVPP, the Institute for Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology, and I've been back several times since because obviously I've maintained a lot of contact out there. And so while I was based in Beijing, we did field work in Inner Mongolia. We did field work down in the south. I've been to museums all over China working on their collections. So I've seen an enormous amount of material and got to do some pretty exciting work. It was really great to work on Microraptor, the famous kind of four-winged dinosaur, and break in the UV work in China, looking at feathers and things and soft tissue preservation under ultraviolet light, which was great fun. So very proud to have done that. And then in terms of field work, I found lots of little bits and pieces while I was out there. So I did find a very nice alvarosaur foot, which I wrote up last year. We found some nice bite marks on some bones that I was able to write up. And about, when was it? I think it was the previous summer, so about 18 months ago now, I was prospecting in Xinjiang in the far west of China, and for the first time found something that I'm really pleased to have found, and it's most of a theropod skeleton.
Oh, wow. Is that published? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it's still in the lab, and it's still being prepped out. I haven't seen it Since I found, well, not quite since I found it. So I found a tip of bone sticking out of the rock. A bit of clearing of the overburden and digging around a bit showed that there was a fair bit of animal there. By that time, it looked like one of the best things we'd found in the season to date. So the whole crew came over and we started digging an enormous hole in the side of a hill. And obviously, you're trying to keep the bones as intact as possible. So you're exposing things to see how far they go into the hill, but trying not to expose them so much that you risk any damage. It's hard to tell from when I last saw it quite how much is in there and quite what it is. So I'm certainly still arguing with the other guys as to what we is, because we only ever saw bits of it. I mean, it's definitely theropod. It's got key theropod characteristics. So we're sure it's a carnivorous dinosaur, part of that carnivorous lineage. It's clearly quite big because there were enough big bits that we know roughly what size it was. And my guess would be it's getting on for 1.5 to 2 meters, snout to pelvis kind of size. Exactly what species it belongs to and whether or not it's something we already know of or something new, time will tell, but I'm still waiting. Send me some photos and then I'll let you know. But it's definitely by far and away the best thing I've ever found in the field. I'm quite pleased with that one.
That's pretty cool. Normally, yeah, that paleontologists are actually pretty bad at finding things in the field, and it's actually just amateurs. So it's pretty cool to actually hear a story of a paleontologist actually finding something which could be pretty pretty sweet, yep. I guess.
I'd done quite a few weeks out in the in China at that point, but never found... Yeah, I found stuff that I had published, found stuff that was definitely worth publishing, but never found anything that good. Certainly not on my own, where I could make a definitive claim that it was me and no one else.
How easy is it to find specimens in China? Because a lot of the time, a lot of the research papers we see is that it's a new specimen from China, it's a new... Yeah, everything just seems to be coming out of China. Is that really because it's... got so many fossils there to be found, or is it more of a case that it hasn't been explored as much? It's a big country. Have they just not spent as had as much of a history of paleontology as other countries such as in the UK, Europe and America?
Yeah, it's all of that combined, I think, Dave. You've got it's a huge area, it's a huge country, there's a huge amount of exposed rock area. And an awful lot of that rock is the right geological age and the right preservational type to have fossils in. So there are definitively a colossal amount of fossils out there in China. But you're right, at the same time, you know, we're only really starting to excavate China, you know, the last 10, 15 years or so, and it's still kind of accelerating at the moment. So unlike, you know, Europe did get done in kind of the late 1800s, the US kicked off in the late 1800s, and while it's still going strong, you know, they do have multiple big areas that have been very thoroughly excavated, even if they're still turning up new things. And you've got some places like Argentina, maybe, and Australia, which are still kind of starting to get going. So there's a lot of fossils. It hasn't really been done before, and it's getting an enormous amount of attention. So that's all kind of pushing the discovery rate up. But at the same time, in some places it's very easy. So I have done a fair bit of work in Inner Mongolia, so that's the Chinese part of Mongolia, and some of the places we go out to, you can't walk 15-20 yards without finding some bone. I mean, it might just be a fragment of something busted that you can't tell what it was, a tiny fragment of eggshell, partial tooth or something like that, but there really is bone every 10-20 yards. You know, you can't go out for a day in the field without coming back with a handful of teeth or a partial foot or a broken jaw or something. We went out, I think it was 3 years ago, we had a crew out, and it was about 30 guys for 4 weeks. We came back with something like 150 jackets of material.
Wow.
And that's plus all the little bags and all the little hand-picked up scraps, which were just hand-wrapped and therefore stored separately. I mean, this is just the stuff that was big enough that we wanted to take it out in a protective plaster case. So, yeah, you're averaging probably a jacketed specimen per person every 2 days. It's quite a rate of discovery. So, of course, most of that stuff is still in storage because we don't have the 300 or 400 preparators we need to clear. You know, we're discovering far faster than we can prepare stuff out.
How is China for getting material out of there? Would you be able to say, if you are a preparator, I can prep this for you if you send the specimen to me? Do they keep it inside the country?
Yeah, the rules of sending material outside, even for scientific research, are extremely tight. So in terms of actually buying and selling stuff, which has caused a lot of furore recently, it's absolutely illegal. It's you really can't do it. There are rules for international exchanges to send material abroad to be prepared or for other people to research on, but it's time consuming to sort out the paperwork and it can be expensive to do. So it just doesn't happen that much.
Have there ever been any collector curves prepared for China, which is where they look at the number of specimens that they've found over time?
I'm not aware of anyone doing it for China on its own. There are them for dinosaurs in general, which obviously include all the Chinese or all the Asian material. I can't think of anything that's been done, but it would just be exponential. I mean, I think the last paper I looked at anyway, the collector curve for dinosaurs as a whole, at least in terms of naming species rather than necessarily just recovering specimens, was still in the exponential phase. So it's just going up faster and faster and faster and faster. And China, I would expect to be a particularly fast bit of that. So it's, I don't know. Plus, of course, you do have this complication of, much like a lot of old museums, actually, there's still unprepared stuff in Berlin from the Tendeguru expeditions in the 1930s. There's still unprepared stuff in the AM&H from the Copenmarsh Bone Wars. The huge amount of stuff which just hasn't been prepared or looked at fully. We probably have got many new and exciting things that we simply haven't even looked at yet. We found them in the field, went, oh, that looks nice, wrapped it all up, put it in storage, and haven't got to it yet.
In your experience, is it pretty easy to get work in a museum if you go down and offer to volunteer to prepare material? Is it pretty easy to get that kind of experience?
It depends on the museum. So I haven't worked that much in museums. Let me rephrase that. I have worked a lot in museums, but most of that was in Germany and China, and I'm really not sure either of them was representative. I do know of preparators who are and have been keen to get volunteers in, and if you can really show that you've got the time and commitment and interest, they will try and train you up and get you going on stuff. So it certainly can happen. How much it varies between places, I imagine there's an awful lot of variation. So you might find some museum who say, yeah, come in tomorrow, we'll get you started, and other places that say, not under any circumstances, no. That's probably not a lot of use.
Well, I was just guessing that if there's people listening that are interested in helping out with this, that just get in touch with your local museum. I know from my experience in Bristol that they have the Bristol Dinosaur Project, where you can go down and offer your help and they might get you preparing some bones out of the rock.
Yeah, I mean, Remit's very good at that, but and he's the one example I was thinking of. Most other places don't like doing it. I know in the US they're quite good about it in a lot of places. The problem is, at least in the UK and Europe, we don't have that much material. And it obviously, therefore, by extension, almost tends to be rather more valuable and people are rather more cagey about it.
Could you quickly tell us what the Ask a Biologist project is?
Yeah, sure. So Ask a Biologist, this was something I set up in, 2004 now, I think. It's a good long time ago. It's been going for quite a while. And it's quite simply, it's a website where people can come along and leave a question, and I and my team, as it were, of professional researchers who are all biologists or paleontologists or anthropologists and medics, we'll try and answer it to the best of our ability. And it's really to try and break the barriers down between the scientist and the general public, in particular children, but we take questions from absolutely anyone. And it really just kind of harks back to when I was, 8 or 9 or 10, and I'd be watching some David Attenborough program, and they would have, cheetahs on or whatever, and saying, these can run it up to 60 miles an hour. And I'd go, how the hell do they know that? I had a wall of animal books and encyclopedias of animal life and history of vertebrates and even technical volumes, which I didn't know how to read because I'd just buy or grab anything with animals on it. And I'd go through all of these and find nothing about any of this kind of stuff. And it wasn't that I didn't disbelieve them, but I just wanted to know how they knew it and what it meant. And there was just no way of accessing that information prior to the internet. And now that we do have the internet, there's ways of accessing 500 different answers, probably, frankly, of which 450 are wrong. And if you don't know and don't have the expertise, you won't be able to sift through them and work out which are going to be more plausible than the others. But here on Ask a Biologist, you know that every person on that site has a PhD or is a biology teacher or is a medical doctor, and we lay out our qualifications and what we work on, and we'll do our best to answer the question. If we don't know, we'll try and find it in the scientific literature. So hopefully, on average, our answers are thorough and accurate.
So you work in the media, writing about paleontology. How is the Chinese media for paleontology?
I wouldn't say I work in the media. I write.
Oh, you contribute.
On their blogging site, but sadly, and I did actually ask when I went in for my training day, I did ask for a hat with a ticket with press in the side. I don't know. The media coverage in China seems to be quite good. Obviously, I don't know Chinese, so the stuff that I saw would always be the English editions or translations that my friends and colleagues were prepared to provide. It actually seemed to be pretty good. And they were certainly very good at promoting good research. The write-ups tended to be pretty accurate. They'd get the basic facts right. They would tend to put it in context correctly, which is more than a lot of places. It seemed to be fairly good, and they were very interested. And there is a big interest in dinosaurs in China. They do like these kinds of things. They do like fossils. And I think it's seen as a bit of a cachet. They recognize that they have huge amounts of fossils that are very interesting and are attracting a lot of worldwide attention. And they see this as a good thing. And they like that fact.
So you mentioned the dinosaur Microraptor earlier. This is one of those spectacular feathered fossil dinosaurs which came from China. How have these fossils in particular, you know, there's a whole range of them, how have they helped guide our understanding for the evolution of birds, the evolution transition between dinosaurs and modern birds?
So these have been a series of very important and very exciting discoveries for us. If you go back about 15, 20 years or so, I think most paleontologists would have agreed that birds were dinosaurs. Birds are living dinosaurs, they're direct descendants of dinosaurs, birds are dinosaurs. And we had a lot of good anatomical evidence for that, but there were still some fairly big gaps. And these fossils from China have really kind of filled those gaps in, both on the kind of dinosaur to bird link, the transition of dinosaurs to birds, and actually the transition from ancient birds right the way up to modern forms. And China's filled in a lot of those gaps on both sides, both in terms of course, the kind of anatomical information you get from bones and teeth and all of these kinds of things, but particularly in terms of feathers. And we see that with all these feathered dinosaurs, of course, you now have feathered dinosaurs, so you've kind of solved that problem for starters. But you can also look at the evolution of the feathers and the feather types, and we see that more basal earlier dinosaurs, earlier theropods, have very simple feathers that look like the kind you get on kiwis or baby chicks, and that these actually get longer and more derived and more specialized and more complex the closer and closer you get to the bird lineage. So we can actually look at the evolution of feathers on its transition from their first origins right the way up to what we see in flying dinosaurs and the first birds right the way through to modern birds. So that's fantastic. And you can also look at how flight perhaps first evolved. No one had ever really had a problem with the idea that feathers must have evolved before flight, at least within birds, obviously not the case for bats and pterosaurs. But, you know, quite how were these being used? Were there animals gliding from tree to tree? Were they running around on the ground, flapping? Quite what might have these feathers have been used for prior to being specialized and modified towards a flying condition? And Microraptor is a great example of that. As a guy called Beebe back in about 1911, I think it was, suggested that maybe birds went through some kind of four-winged transition where the arms and legs both had lots of feathers and gave it a bit of lift and laid it to glide effectively, and then only later it would shift the arms to modify towards powered flight so they could flap them and generate more thrust and lift through that. And of course, this hypothesis then resurrected when Microraptor turned up, because it's a fully feathered dinosaur. It's not a bird. It's part of the dromaeosaur lineage, which includes things like Velociraptor, which everyone's heard of, and Deinonychus and various other things. And Microraptor does have big flight feathers on the arms. They're flight feathers. They're asymmetric. So these are used to generate airfoil exactly as you'd see in a bird feather, a pigeon or gull or whatever. But it also has the same kind of feathers on its legs. So it does have at least potentially 4 aerofoils on there, which is just fantastic. And of course, this is the kind of thing you'd never guess and you wouldn't be able to detect from the bones alone. You would have some indications maybe that there were feathers there because there are correlations in the bones to feathers, but what kind of feathers and exactly what layout they had and which parts of the body they were present and how they were attached, you just wouldn't see without these fossils. So they really are phenomenally important and significant in that sense.
You mentioned that Archaeopteryx was a dinosaur-like bird and the Microraptors a bird-like dinosaur. So what's the cutoff in between? Where do we say that this is a bird and this is a dinosaur?
That's obviously a good question. And like a lot of things in taxonomy, you know, where do you draw the line? You know, what exactly is a species? You know, we have multiple species concepts because of this very problem. And it, at one level, it really is just kind of a level of convenience. You know, when Archaeopteryx was discovered, this was a time without any small dinosaurs, really without any bird-like dinosaurs. And quite simply, this was an animal that had flight feathers. And it was understandable at that point to go, okay, this has got to be a bird. You know, nothing but birds have feathers. This has got feathers. This is a bird. Now, it could have turned out, I suppose, that, you know, if the eventual phylogenetic position after all of our later study and research has, had shown that Archaeopteryx was nested well within dinosaurs and may have been close to Tyrannosaurus Rex or something like that, we may well have shifted the division or something. But rather conveniently, there is this nice split of the radiation of the derived non-avian theropods, whereby we do get these successive branching of tyrannosaurs and therizinosaurs and various other things, right up to the point you get these two groups, the dromaeosaurs and the troodontids, which are extremely bird-like, or at least extremely Archaeopteryx-like, might be a better statement of this. And then we get the division of Archaeopteryx and everything else. So it is an artificial cutoff, and it's a, you know, as a lot of things for biology, it's a convenience rather than anything else. But there are some characters which lie on the avian side that don't lie on the non-avian side. So we do have, we are able to establish that point, but it's certainly not impossible that it's going to move. And indeed, the phylogenetic positions of these things may move. It is not impossible. I personally think it's implausible. I know some of my colleagues disagree, but I know several people who are quite happy with the idea that, you know, a bit more data and filling in a few more specimens might be enough to tip the dromaeosaurs towards the avian side of that split, for example. And we might have to start considering Velociraptor to be a bird, effectively, because it would fall on the other side of the divide. It, you know, it sounds odd, but of course it's, that's no more different to kind of, you know, well, what side of, you know, humanity do you place Homo habilis and Homo erectus and Neanderthal and all the rest of it? You know, which should these really be considered modern humans or not? And it's really just a case of making sure we have a solid case of putting them one side or the other, but everyone knows that and everyone is sticking to the same definition rather than it's right or wrong to consider one or the, over the other.
So you quickly mentioned tyrannosaurs and therizinosaurs there. I mean, were these feathered theropods too? Were all theropods feathered, or are there some exceptions?
Yeah, that's the next kind of big question. So we do have a... If you look at the kind of classic phylogeny of theropods or non-avian theropods from the earliest point at which they split from the very early dinosaurs right the way up to the line of birds, you could probably draw a line about halfway up, and all of the upper half, we now have exceptionally good evidence that they have feathers. I mean, quite literally, we have specimens with feathers on. So we have a couple of tyrannosaurs that definitely have feathers. We have a troodontid with feathers. We now have an ornithomimus with feathers. Bloody, bloody, blah. Stuff below that, we currently have no direct evidence for any of them having feathers. So there is no single fossil that I'm aware of any of those which definitively has feathers preserved on it. But of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't have them. They could well have just been not preserved. And of course, you know, it's taken us a long time to find anything with feathers on. So it wouldn't at all be a big surprise if a few more of these lineages did indeed have some feathers. We just haven't found them yet. There is a tentative suggestion that some more basal ones did have feathers. So pushing, if you like, that line further down the family tree towards the base of theropods, towards the base of dinosaurs as a whole. But the really basal stuff, there's currently no good evidence in any shape or form that they had. Of course, that doesn't mean that they didn't. And at one level, it's looking increasingly likely that perhaps they did, because we do have, you know, perfect evidence that derived theropods had feathers. We actually have good evidence that several ornithischians, so one of the big herbivorous lineages of dinosaurs, at least a couple of those had, well, not feathers, but certainly feather-like quills, you know, the simple filaments that, again, would look like you'd see on a chick, kiwi, or a cassowary or something like that. And actually we see short feather-like filaments in pterodactyls, which are the sister taxa to the dinosaurs. So there is the possibility, and I do say possibility, not probability, there is the possibility that in fact some kind of feather-like structure was primitive for dinosaurs, but was actually lost in the sauropod group and was lost in most of the ornithischian group. In which case, it's almost certain, actually, that most of the theropods had feathers of one kind or another.
Which were the most primitive morphology of feathers? Because you have a whole host of different ones now. You have the down, you have flight feathers.
Yeah, there's quite a few kinds out there. And also there's some kinds that we find in dinosaurs which we don't see in modern birds. So there did seem to be a bit of kind of evolutionary experimentation going on with when they first appeared. You do get quite a few clear and distinct types, though. And again, most of these actually still turn up in modern birds. So you get kind of long, true flight feathers like you get on the tips of wings of most birds. You get shorter, symmetrical, fluffy feathers that you get on the body. Again, if you pluck the chest of a pigeon or a chicken or something like that, those feathers are rather different to what you get on the wingtips. You do get very long, kind of filamentous feathers. Again, you get on kiwis, you get on cassowaries and rheas and things like this. And then you get very short, kind of down-like fluffy feathers that you get on things like baby chicks. But we also see some other weird ones within the dinosaurs. There are some which have almost like, they're a sheet of keratin rather than obviously the tiny little barbs and barbules. You know, if you handle a feather, you can break it up into all its little subunits. Some of these seem to be almost more like a giant, flat, thin scale. There's just a solid sheet. We don't find them in any modern birds, but they turn up in a couple of dinosaur lineages. But the most primitive form that we seem to see, so the that is present on the most basal dinosaurs, are very simple spike-like structures. I mean, they do look almost like the bristles of a pig are probably the best analogy I can give. They'd be flexible but relatively stiff, and certainly not particularly soft and fluffy like you might expect. And then they grew longer and longer and longer, and then started to branch, and then those branches started to sub-branch, and that eventually gives you the modern feather structure that we're most familiar with.
We've been talking a lot about these feathers that have actually been preserved, and feathers are obviously soft tissue, but not hard like bone. What are some of the other kinds of soft tissue preservation that we see in the fossil record, especially maybe from China as well?
Yeah, well, there's all kinds. It's worth remembering that feathers are relatively tough. It's perhaps not a big surprise that we get relatively large numbers of feathers preserved. And, you know, if you've ever seen a bird being left outside that died at the side of the road, there's been there for really quite a long time, and actually most of the feathers are still intact on the wings. They're very robust things that don't decay very quickly, and they are actually physically stuck to the bone, so they don't tend to get separated. One sense, it's not a big surprise. They do obviously decay much faster than bones ever would, but they're probably the most robust soft tissue going that's most likely to survive. But we do see feathers. We do see claws on the feet, the keratinous sheath, you know, kind of equivalent to your fingernail or toenail, they get preserved. Beaks get preserved, which is quite nice. We do see bits of skin. We do see bits of muscle tissue. In the case of a few things, we have got impressions of some of the internal organs, or what are considered parts of the internal organs. There's a couple of salamanders I've seen, or tadpoles of salamanders I've seen from China, which actually seem to have the eyes preserved, or at least presumably the pigments that helped make up the retina have preserved. There's a nice big black circular stain in each of the eye sockets, which is really quite phenomenal. So really there's all kinds of soft tissues that can survive. though of course the conditions have to be just about perfect, and they need to have not decayed beforehand, and in any case they're going to get pretty much flattened. So there can be a lot that potentially you can dig out of it, but you've got to remember that it's gone through some, you know, some fairly horrific taphonomy and alterations in the meantime.
One of the things you mentioned was that you found direct evidence of feeding relationships on some of these bones. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I found, I found with some colleagues some traces of Protoceratops bones. This is a skeleton of a Protoceratops, of one of the horned dinosaurs, which had been very badly eroded. The skeleton had almost gone. And my colleagues found some Velociraptor teeth that were alongside it. And at the time, I happened to have been reading up on bite marks and feeding traces on bones. And so I asked them to show me the skeleton and where they'd found it, because they'd only collected the teeth. We went through, sorted through all the bony fragments and found a handful of them that did have bite marks on. So you can see these scrape marks where the teeth have dug into the bone and been dragged across it and left these wonderful little grooves and scrapes across the bones. And these are present in not a huge number of fossils, but they are out there where the animal has died, whether it's been actively killed by a predator or whether it died of natural causes, and then later been fed upon through scavenging. But you will find cases where theropod teeth marks are left on the bones. The theropods have lost their teeth as a result of biting on the bones. At least one case I know of in Canada where there's a tooth physically jammed into the bone, which is particularly cool. So there are a bunch of these out there, and I've been lucky enough to find that one in the field in that case, be offered to work on a specimen from in Mexico that had similar kind of marks, and one from Mongolia that I've done. So I have worked quite a bit on feeding traces and bite marks, which has been fascinating to do.
You mentioned that the Protoceratops had been pretty badly degraded. Mm. So if you're looking for teeth marks on it, how can you say that this is definitely a mark where a tooth has scraped along it and nothing else?
Very good question. Several reasons, and in that particular case, quite a few actually. So on average, you can often tell because the marks do have certain patterns which are only normally are made by teeth. So the bite marks tend to be multiple sub-parallel grooves, which if you can imagine with these things with their sharp teeth, if they bite onto a bone and drag the head along, they're going to leave grooves and they're going to be parallel. Of course, random cracking and breaking won't leave something so consistent like that. People have actually done studies of this, so they have actually left bones out to erode naturally and get, you know, heated up and cooled down in the environment and get rained on all the rest of it and see how they crack and break. So we know what natural breakdown of bones and fossil bones looks like, so we can compare them, so that helps. Also, the shape of them, if you can match them, the shape or the spacing between them, if you can match them to the shape and spacing of the teeth, then obviously you can line them up quite nicely, which you're able to do on occasion. And in the case of this Protoceratops, the thing was very badly eroded, but a lot of the stuff was still buried under the sand. So we were able to dig down to some of the stuff which hadn't been as badly eroded and hadn't broken up properly yet, and compare that to the stuff that was on the surface. And we were able to see what the kind of pattern breakdown was. And of course, in at least a couple of cases, some of the stuff we dug up did have bite marks on it, and it hadn't been lying around on the surface. So, of course, we're very happy that that's a, you know, pre-existing condition. You do have to be careful, of course, but if you can line up even half of that evidence, you can make a pretty convincing case that it's a real bite mark. And in our case, we had shed teeth alongside it, so we knew exactly it had dropped its teeth and they were next to a piece of bone which had score marks all over it. So it's pretty nailed on in that one.
Do dinosaurs have pretty varied arrangement of teeth? Because am I right in thinking that humans and dogs and apes and all that lot have the same kind of pattern of teeth? So you have like four flat ones at the front and then your two incisors either side. Is that the same for all mammals?
It's not the same for all mammals because, of course, they've lost them or duplicated them or moved them around in various ways. But there is a fairly common primitive pattern Though, of course, you get gaps. So, if you look at a horse skeleton, for example, or a horse skull would probably be preferable. There's a fairly big gap between the anterior teeth, which it nips with, and the posterior teeth, which it's grinding up with. You have this diastema, this large space within the skull. In the case of the dinosaurs, I mean, they are, more reptilian, and so there is less major differentiation between their teeth than you see within mammals, say. You look at a typical mammal, and you do have very obvious and distinct types of teeth. You will see much less of that within the dinosaurs. But even so, you do see differences between the front teeth and the rear teeth. So, for example, tyrannosaurs, if you just looked at them, you might think that all of those teeth are just kind of big, classically curved and slightly serrated chomping teeth, which they certainly are. But the teeth at the front of the jaw are actually rather more robust, and they have a rather different cross-sectional shape to those further back along the jaw. There is a differentiation there. So they're certainly, on average, more similar to each other within the jaws in dinosaurs than they are within mammals, but there are differences and specializations there. And at least in a couple of cases, there's quite extreme specialization. There's a group of ornithischians called the heterodontosaurs, whose name means different type of teeth lizard. And they do have like kind of fangs that stick out from the side. They look rather like the Chinese water deer, the chevrotins we see, these little deer that actually have fangs. We see almost exactly the same thing in these ornithischians. So in those cases, at least you've got a very specialized dentition there that's present.
I did want to ask about the, you did some research on the actual dinosaur inside a dinosaur. Was it Velociraptor eating a bird or something?
Oh, yeah, no, so there's a, this is another specimen. It's a Mongolian specimen which is held in a museum in Japan, and it's a fairly complete Velociraptor, which has a chunk of bone sat within the chest cavity, so it's actually inside the body, which is from a pterosaur, from quite a large pterosaur as far as we can tell. And the piece of bone, though fragmented, is so large it wouldn't actually fit between the ribs. So this wasn't something that got in there by accident, but is something that therefore the Velociraptor must have eaten. So it had crunched up and swallowed down this chunk of bone from this pterosaur skeleton and left it within the stomach. There's actually a fair few number of dinosaurs, of theropods out there, with bits of bone within the stomach. There's a Tyrannosaurus specimen which has this. There's at least 5 or 6 incidents of this now, which is really nice. The sad thing is, from my perspective, that few of them have been described in great detail. You'll get papers that say, hey, we found a dog. It's got another dinosaur inside it. And that's about the limit of the information. So if you don't see it yourself or a more thorough description turns out, there's little you can do to try to cross-compare them, unfortunately.
In these cases, would it be possible to distinguish between scavenging and predation?
Yeah, normally you can't. It's going to be very, very hard to do that, because if you can imagine a wildebeest or a buffalo or something like that gets killed out on the Serengeti, and the lions and the hyena and the jackals all turn up and tear it apart, and just the whole carcass gets disintegrated, that's going to be almost impossible to tell apart from a buffalo which has just died, of natural causes, or it's got ill or something. And then the lions and hyenas and jackals turn up and tear it apart. The overall pattern of destruction of the carcass is going to be almost impossible to tell one from the other. So you're not going to be able to make any firm inferences on that. But in this case, we're exceptionally lucky because we have this evidence that the carcass was transported prior to death. That's not the kind of thing a Tarbosaurus is going to do, dragging this hadrosaur downstream. It was partially buried already. Again, that's not going to happen if the animal's just been killed. And the carcass consumption pattern of the Tarbosaurus feeding just on the humerus and ignoring the rest of the carcass completely and leaving so many bite marks on the humerus, collectively, that makes a really very good case that this is genuinely scavenging. So that is very nice. But the vast majority of the time, you're not going to be able to make those kinds of you're not going to be able to make that kind of distinction based on the available material. We were very lucky, and it certainly shows. There are other cases out there which I'm pretty happy are scavenging. We just can't necessarily prove it. And there are a couple out there which are pretty definitively predation, because the animal, the attempted prey species or individual, has survived. and it's got away with some enormous bite mark or even a tooth embedded in the bone, but has lived to fight another day. So clearly something tried to kill it. That's obviously attempted predation. And of course, collectively, that means we do have evidence both for predation and scavenging in the fossil record for various groups, including the tyrannosaurs, which is really nice and hopefully finally begins to end that endless predation versus scavenging argument.
So it must be pretty rare to find such cases where you can observe feeding relationships directly. Are there ever any other examples you've worked on where you can say this species definitely fed on this other one?
There have been some other bits that I've put together. Of course, you know, how exact you can get in each case is pretty tricky. Generally, you've got either a complete herbivore with various bite marks on it, and then, of course, the challenge is to correctly attribute the right carnivorous species to those bite marks, or alternatively, you have a nice skeleton of a carnivore with only a few bone fragments of something else inside it, and then you've got to try and work out what they belong to. And obviously, depending on exactly what bits you've got and exactly what data is available, the positions can be more or less certain. But there is another specimen of Microraptor, so there's multiple specimens of Microraptor out there, and actually the first one to be described is this little partial skeleton, again from China. It was only recently, actually, that when I was still in China and had some colleagues visiting, that one of them spotted that completely overlooked, as far as we can tell by all our previous colleagues and researchers who looked at this specimen, there's actually a mammal foot inside the rib cage. So you have got the, you know, relatively large piece of an animal which has been bitten off and swallowed whole. So that's another great incidence where we've got, we know exactly what Microraptor is. This is actually the holotype specimen. And then there's enough material of that foot that we can probably make a relatively reliable diagnosis as to what species, or certainly at least which relatively major group this belongs to. There's actually a mammalogist still looking at that, so I don't actually know what the final answer is. But, you know, we haven't just got a fragment of bone. We've actually got a complete articulated pes, which is obviously quite a lot of information at that level.
Yeah, if it's still completely articulated, it must have been ingested pretty soon before the actual Microraptor died. Is it possible that it maybe choked to death on this foot?
In this case, probably not, because it has got the stuff right into the chest cavity. It's not jammed anywhere near the throat. Though there is a dinosaur we've got floating around at the IVPP, which may or may not have suffered that fate. There is actually one which has got another skeleton lodged close to the neck, close to rather than necessarily in, so we're a bit uncertain about it. It's possible. But it's worth remembering that lots of animals die in lots of weird and unusual ways. Animals will choke to death feeding on the wrong kind of thing or swallowing it badly and getting it stuck in the throat. Giraffes get killed by lightning strikes. All kinds of weird accidents occur. And there's lots of records, for example, of deer getting their antlers caught in trees and that killing them. And years ago, I saw a wonderful photo of a pair of kudu skulls, so this large African antelope, and the heads were kind of back to back with these long spiral horns, completely locked and entangled together to the point that they clearly could never free themselves, and presumably either starved to death or became very easy prey for a predator marauding along. But these things really are quite common. They happen rather more often than I think people think. Though, of course, the challenge for us, or at least the luck involved for us, is actually finding one of these. But I wouldn't be shocked at all if we one day found a pair of ceratopsian skulls in this kind of arrangement or something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention about the these kind of characters like antlers, because we can see sexual selection is a really important driving force of evolution today. Do we actually see that kind of thing in the past?
Well, this is something that I've been writing on quite heavily with several other colleagues, and we at least are very strongly convinced that it's an extraordinarily important part of paleontology and has, or at least vertebrate paleontology, and has perhaps been rather unfairly overlooked or ignored in the past. And to be fair, I think a lot of people have thought the main problem was that it would be so hard to detect that it's something that perhaps we shouldn't deal with, or at least it would be an unfortunate way of invoking a hypothesis of, oh, well, this thing has a big weird crest, this thing has big weird horns, this thing has some weird tail or whatever. therefore it's sexual selection, but oh, we can't test it, so isn't that a convenient hypothesis that gets us out of a hole? And I have sympathy with that position, but I think there are ways of determining potentially whether or not something may be sexually selected. And certainly, as you say, we know sexual selection is a phenomenally important point or important part and component of evolution in modern animals. You know, the, as you say, you know, horns and antlers in deer and bovids and ovids and all of these kinds of things, you know, the feather patterns and colors and distributions of feathers in all manner of birds and display structures in lizards and chameleon colors and all the rest and horns. You know, all of this is sexually selected stuff, or at least very strongly linked to sexual selection. It would be a pretty big shock if large chunks of fossil species didn't have some kind of sexual selection going on. You know, sex is, you know, after just surviving and getting enough to eat and avoiding being eaten by predators, the next thing is passing your genes on. And, you know, sexual selection therefore kicks in and produces things like peacocks and produces things like the antlers on stag.
So regarding dinosaurs, it's been suggested that some, like the sauropods, had like a kind of bigger is better mode of sexual selection regarding their necks. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so this is an idea which came out five or six years ago now. And I have to say I wasn't terribly convinced. And again, myself and a group of colleagues sat down to write about this because we really didn't agree. So we're in this odd position where I'm very strongly advocating sexual selection as a major driver of evolutionary change in unusual characteristics in organisms, whilst saying that the one major argument that had been put forward within dinosaurs is probably not the example you should use. So yeah, it was suggested that basically, you know, sauropod dinosaurs, these giant bodied animals like Brachiosaurus and Diplodocus and the others, had big bodies, long necks, long tails. And it was suggested that the long necks were sexually selected, that effectively males were growing longer and longer necks in order to basically advertise to females that they were superior because they could carry around this extra weight and they could still feed and all the rest of it, despite this effective penalty of this huge neck, and therefore was sexually selected. But as I say, we really didn't agree because we didn't think the evidence was there to stack this up. It didn't seem to be necessarily an obvious penalty. You don't see the kind of growth trajectories that you'd necessarily expect from sexual selection. And the other problem is, and this is a big problem when you're looking at sexual selection, is an awful lot of features can be multifunctional. They have multiple functions. You know, we're used to looking at things like, you know, bighorn sheep that fight with the two males getting their, you know, giant horns together, and they charge each other and bang into each other. And the bigger male, or the male with the bigger horns, tends to win. And that's a sexually selected characteristic, which it certainly is. But they also will fight off predators with their horns. So it has two functions there immediately. And actually, it's been shown that, in part, the blood supply in the horns helps to cool the brain when the environment gets hot. So whilst it has been shown that these horns are sexually selected, and it's a very strong component of the evolution and origin of these horns, they are also functioning in predator defense, and they are also functioning in brain cooling. So it's very hard, at least potentially, to tease out what may or may not be an evolutionary driver for a given function. And of course, it's even harder in the fossil record. On the flip side, I think it's worth saying that you can certainly determine that some things definitely aren't operating in certain ways, for example. And in other cases, you can suggest, or there's good evidence to show, that these things are pretty minor. So brain cooling, I'm sure, is the case, but it's clearly not the big driver of horns in bighorn sheep. But it does mean that this multifunctionality is a problem for trying to work out things that may or may not be sexually selected. And in the case of the sauropod neck, we were able to show that actually an elongate neck does increase feeding efficiency. It's likely to have a major impact on how well and how effectively you can feed, whether that means you raise your neck to the trees or actually just stop you moving around and you can use your neck to sweep lots of grass in the way that geese do when they graze. And there appeared to be better evidence on average for neck elongation as a feeding efficiency tool than there was for sexual selection.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Dave.
Yep, thanks very much.
No worries. Sure. Cheers, guys.
For an arthropod lover, listening to an episode of Vertebrates, I actually found that pretty interesting.
Dave left us on quite a nice little note there. He was talking about the sexual selection in sauropods.
Yeah, sexual selection is something that we can see in animals today to be so important to them, and so it probably was as important for animals in the past as well. So that's definitely something that we should look more into in future episodes.
That sounds really good, Dave. I hope we can explore that avenue more in the future. And thanks for recording this with me today. It's been enlightening, I think, for us both.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'll see you next time.
Yep, I'll see you at Pat. Oh yeah, right, we should say. Me and Dave are off to the Paleontological Association's annual general meeting in Dublin.
Yep, we're going to be at the University College Dublin on the 16th to 18th of December. And there we'll be really trying to give you an insight as to what goes on at these kind of conferences. We're going to be having a stall, and hopefully, if you're an academic listening to this, pop by, say hi, and...
And we might give you a free flyer.
Yeah, we'll give you a badge. We don't have any. But we'll give you a high five.
Yep, we'll have a stall there, so come by and say hello.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.